From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Will Cyprus be the financial mouse that roared? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The island nation of Cyprus has 1.1 million people, but it's becoming a threat to the entire Eurozone, 317 times larger. It's all about banks structured as tax shelters, often for wealthy Russians. Banks now in so much trouble they've asked for a bailout. But when Eurozone leaders proposed to tax every depositor, ordinary Cypriots took to the streets, emptying ATMs and forcing Parliament to reject the deal. What about depositors in Greece and other troubled countries? Will they lose faith in their own banks and their confidence in the euro? On Reporter's Notebook later on, an unlikely political comeback in South Carolina. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Wyman Alney, back with To the Point. Financial trouble in tiny Cyprus is the latest threat to the entire Eurozone. With their banks in danger, should ordinary Cypriots be taxed to protect wealthy Russians? Would that precedent lead to a run on banks with problems in other countries? We'll untangle those and other questions today. On Reporter's Notebook, Mark Sanford plans to marry the Argentine mistress that he lied about when he was governor of South Carolina. Can he win back his old seat in Congress? First, this news update. President Obama is in Jerusalem, his first stop before going to Ramallah and Jordan. He made a public appearance today with Israeli President Shimon Peres.
It is wonderful to be back in Jerusalem, this eternal city, and I'm pleased to begin my visit with a son of Israel who's devoted his life to keeping Israel strong and sustaining the bonds between our two nations.
And here is President Peres.
Your vision can be transformed the Middle East. Your vision is achievable. You arrived here already with an impressive record of answering our needs.
Joel Greenberg is Jerusalem correspondent for The Washington Post. Joel, good to have you with us.
Good to be back.
This is the president's first trip to Israel as president. He talked about the unbreakable bond between the two countries. Do Israelis really believe that?
Well, I think he has broken some of the ice with Israelis. They've been wary of him, and he's been popularly perceived here as tilting away from Israel, mostly because of his disagreements with Prime Minister Netanyahu about the peace process and policy toward Iran. But certainly the coverage here has been very positive, and just talking to people on the street today, I think that there's a readiness to listen, and he's going to give a public address to the Israeli people tomorrow that many people say they will watch.
What about his trip to Ramallah? There have been demonstrations against him there.
Yes, I think those were mostly scattered. I would say that most Palestinians are disappointed in advance, I should say. They're not expecting much. They realize that the focus of this trip is on Israel, and some people who oppose U.S. policies toward the Palestinians have been doing these demonstrations. They haven't swept up masses of people in the street because I think most people just don't expect very much from the visit anyway. So there's not much anticipation and a lot of skepticism there.
So will the focus really be on Israel then, or will it be on Iran and its nuclear program and on Syria and the rather confusing reports about chemical weapons?
Yes, the chemical weapons reports certainly have come up today. They haven't been openly discussed, but obviously Iran and Syria are urgent. The Palestinian issue is urgent, but I think perceived to be less so, and so it will definitely be on the agenda. And I think that President's visit will be followed by work by Secretary of State Kerry to try to get Israelis and Palestinians back to the table. But the clock ticking on the Iranian program and the events in Syria certainly will top the agenda.
When the president got off the plane, he was heard to say to Prime Minister Netanyahu he was glad to be out of Washington and not have to deal with the Congress right away. Does it appear that they're beginning to sort of thaw the relationship between the two of them?
Well, I think they're trying to make a good show of it. What was unusual today at the airport reception was that there were microphones right with the leaders. You could hear their conversations, their off-the-cuff remarks, And I think this was intentional. Obviously, this was done by the Israeli side to project an image of an easy, informal, friendly relationship. There's been great effort invested in that.
Israel, of course, is an enormously complicated place. And every time we say something such as you did, that Israelis have been wary about Obama, that may be true of some Israelis, but not others. How difficult an issue do you think, or how difficult a challenge does he have in trying to become more popular, to be more accepted by more people in Israel?
Well, I think there is a challenge. Again, I think it stems from the policy differences. Past presidents have had perhaps better rapport, like President Clinton, but in those days he was working with then Prime Minister Rabin on a peace process. And so the friendship was natural. I think the rapport was natural. Today you've got two administrations who've been at odds, for example, over moves on the Palestinian issue. And so it's harder to promote that image. I think President Obama is trying to go around that by speaking directly to the Israeli people in a speech he's supposed to give Thursday, and try to tell Israelis why it's in their interest and everyone's interest to pursue a peace initiative here, which will be Israel's ultimate security.
Do you think that the issue of the settlements will come up when they are talking behind closed doors?
I think they may, but the consensus here is that the president will not make this a top issue as he did early in his first term, something that brought him into direct confrontation with the Israelis and which he later backed off on. This may come up later in the work that Secretary Kerry does, and it's not at all clear that the president is coming here to present these issues. He said in an interview to Israel television before he arrived that he will come to listen. And basically the message is that he's in listening mode. So maybe some general ideas, but the nitty-gritty work will have to come later.
Very quickly, Hillary Clinton was very popular in Israel. Is John Kerry well-known, and is he popular too?
He is known. He's been here before, and I don't know if the word is popular. People consider him a serious diplomat and expect to do some work with him. Again, how much give he'll get from the new Israeli government, which has some key supporters of Jewish settlement of the territories, along with centrists as well, it remains to be seen. But he is certainly well-known here in Israel.
Joel Greenberg in Jerusalem for The Washington Post. As always, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you.
In a moment, will Cyprus be the financial mouse that roared? On To the Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Werman Olney back with To the Point. In the tiny island nation of Cyprus in the Mediterranean Sea, banks are structured as tax shelters for investors from other countries. Now those banks are in trouble, and Cyprus has asked for a bailout from its Eurozone partners. Led by Germany, Eurozone institutions have proposed a tax on all the depositors, not just the wealthy, but also on ordinary Cypriots saving up for the future. That has created a crisis that could be a threat to the entire Eurozone. Stefanos Evripidou is a chief reporter at the Cyprus Mail. That's an English language paper in Nicosia. Thank you very much for being on our program.
My pleasure.
Tell us, if you will, what now is the mood in the street after days when there were runs on ATMs and people were very angry and demonstrating in front of the parliament?
Well, after the initial shock, there's just one of exasperation and uncertainty right now, because nobody really knows what's going to happen next. The banks have been closed since last Friday. Monday was a public holiday, and they were meant to open on Tuesday. They haven't, and we've just received word that they will be closed until next Tuesday.
So the banks will have been closed for an entire week.
That's right, and obviously that means the economy isn't running properly. We even had an announcement from our petrol station association saying, please pay for your fuel, your gas, in cash, because we can't purchase more gas unless it's in cash only. So right now we seem to have gone back to the Middle Ages, and no one's really certain what on earth is going on.
Are people beginning to run out of cash?
Well, my boss, for instance, only had 25 euros in his pocket when I asked him to buy us a pizza because of all the late hours we've been putting in.
well, Well, I hope the pizza was tasty and that you can get another one when you're called upon to do it. What about the or who decides when the banks will open up again?
Look, it's quite simple. Until we solve the issue of how Cyprus will be bailed out and whether it will be bailed out, opening the banks would be disastrous because there will be an automatic bank run, an immediate bank run, which would then lead to the country's collapse, because we have 68 billion euros worth of capital in Cypriot banks. Now, you mentioned in the introduction that Cyprus is a tax haven, but I'd just like to note that Cyprus is a member of the EU and does apply all EU laws on the banking system. So gone with the days of the 1990s, when money used to be loose and carefree coming in and out of Cyprus. Cyprus had a very successful financial services center and attracted a lot of capital because its corporate tax rate was low, although the effective tax rate was pretty much in line with many other EU countries. But what's happened now is that the main reason we're in this situation, the Greek haircut that was imposed on Greece actually led to 4 billion euro losses for the Cypriot banks. Now, that's 25% of the GDP of the entire country, by the way, just so you get some perspective on how small Cyprus is. But so that's led the banks to be in a very tricky situation. The European Central Bank says it can no longer provide liquidity for those banks. The state itself, due to its exposure to Greek state bonds, has not been able to borrow money from the markets, so they've been locked out the markets, and we've reached a situation where we need approximately 15 to 17 billion euros in bailout. Now, I do believe President Obama is in the region. Israel's just 35 minutes away, so if Air Force One happens to be passing over our airspace, would be really appreciate just a drop-off box of any loose change you guys have.
Well, we'll see if he does that. We know he's going to Ramallah and he's going to Jordan. We're not sure if he's planning to pass over Cyprus on his way back home out of that part of the country, the part of the world.
It would be our pleasure to host him. But seriously, though, we are in a very sticky situation. And there seems to be some kind of there's a lot of other things going on at the same time here, where there seems to be some kind of a clash between Germany and Russia. Germany doesn't like the fact that Russia parks a lot of its money in Cyprus and says, well, we're not going to use German taxpayers' money to bail out Cyprus, let the Russian depositors do it. But again, there's a misconception that all the money in Cyprus is Russian. It's not. From the 70 billion, about 20 billion is Russian. The rest is not. So what they're really actually targeting depositors from all over the world, and from mostly from Cyprus. So people, pensioners, young people, whether it's 500 or 100,000 in the bank, what the mood on the street is that people, for the first time in the Eurozone, Brussels has decided to punish prudent savers as opposed to risk takers who buy bonds. And I think that's what's really hit a raw nerve here, because we're the first in the Eurozone to do this, and then it just seems morally wrong to hit the depositors.
This did not happen when other countries ran into trouble. Prudent savers, as you call them, were not taxed or punished in any way.
No, this is the fifth Eurozone bailout after Portugal, Spain, Greece, and Ireland. And Cyprus is the first where they're asking for a depositor bail-in.
Okay. Well,
which is an oxymoron in itself, a bail-in, but yes.
Okay. I understand that there are meetings going on as we speak. You need to go and cover those. Tell us, if you will, what's happening and where you're going next.
Well, look, the latest I can tell you is not official, but it is reports that have been going around, and those are that the government is currently, having exhausted various scenarios after Parliament rejected the bailout deal last night, what they're doing now is considering going back to look at the haircut on the bank levy on depositors, but at the same time trying to find money from other sources so that the haircut on depositors is not as great as it originally was when the Eurogroup took their controversial decision last Friday night. So this is the latest that we're hearing. It's not official, but what we're hearing is that the government is trying to raise a few billion from other sources. We've heard things like nationalizing provident funds of semi-government organizations. And at the same time, the remainder of the money that they have to come up with to release the $10 billion that the IMF and the EU is willing to lend Cyprus, they will probably come up with that remainder using by slapping a haircut on bank deposits. But the biggest fear here is what happens the next day. Any levy on a bank deposit, on somebody's savings, what happens the next day? Does that person, whether they're Russian, Cypriot, British or American, do they then get up the next day and take their money out the country, leaving a massive gap whereby the banks end up having to find $50 billion to pay depositors? And if that's the case, then they don't have that. The state will have to find that. If the state could just about squeeze $10 billion from the EU, does this whole solution that Brussels has come up with end up resulting in the collapse of the Cypriot economy anyway, but just further down the line, possibly after the German elections?
Stefanos Evrapidou with the English language newspaper Cyprus Mail. Very good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us on a very busy day, and good luck getting another pizza.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Jack Ewing is European economics correspondent for the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune. Jack Ewing, good to have you on our program.
Yeah, good to be here.
Can you take us through the last few days and back up what we just heard from Stefanos Evrapidou about step-by-step what happened here? When did it become apparent that the banks in Cyprus were in trouble? When was this bailout proposed with what he refers to as a penalty on prudent savers?
Well, we've known for at least a year, probably longer, that the Cyprus banks had big problems. And one reason it's such a big problem is that the banking system itself, their total assets and deposits and so on, is, I think, something like seven times the size of the whole Cyprus economy. So when the banks are in trouble, that's a huge problem for the country. But it's all come to a head in the last couple of weeks when it became clear that the banks were going to collapse unless they got a rescue. And if they collapse, as my Cypriot colleague just said, if they collapse, then that would be the end of the Cyprus economy. So on Saturday in Brussels, the European leaders got together. The IMF was represented, the ECB. And after an all-nighter, they decided that they came up with this plan, which required Cyprus to come up with about $7.5 billion. And there's some different accounts of how it all went down, but the end result was that they were asking the depositors, even if you only had $50 or 50 euros in your account, to pay a tax of a little less than 7%. And that, I think, was a major miscalculation and has led to the crisis that we're experiencing right now.
How is it if the assets of the banks are seven times greater than the entire Cypriot economy? How is it that, as we heard earlier, Cyprus banks are operating according to EU rules, or aren't they?
Well, that's very hard to say, and I've been told by independent foreign diplomats that Cyprus has pretty much cleaned up its act compared to the 90s, but there's certainly still a very widespread perception in Germany, where I am, and throughout Europe, that Cyprus is at the very least a tax haven for foreigners, particularly Russians. And it is clear when you're in Cyprus that there is a big Russian influence. So it's hard to say what's really going on, but probably what's important is there is that perception that it's a haven for the Russians, and therefore a big reluctance by the Germans and some other Europeans to bail out banks because they see that as bailing out to Russian oligarchs.
How was it decided, do you know, that there would be a tax on all depositors, even small ones, as you say, with 50 bucks in the bank, when that's never been done before in all the banks bailouts that have occurred, Portugal, Spain, Greece, and Ireland?
Yeah, in fact, there's very little precedent for this anywhere in history when you look around the world. It's really a very unique type of thing. The account that I've heard, and I think we'll probably be learning more about this as time goes on, but was that the European leaders really only wanted to tax the big depositors, and that the president of Cyprus was reluctant to do that because it would have meant taking, I think, a 12-15% from all of the wealthy people that have their money there. And I think they would. He was worried that would destroy the Cyprus as a banking location. No one would ever want to use Cyprus banks again. So he spread it out to include the small depositors. And the Germans insist that this is not something that they wanted. And that's really where the trouble started. I think if it had been limited to oligarchs, it might not have been as bad a crisis as we see now.
Jack Ewing reports on European economies for the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune. Alexander Apostolidis is lecturer in economic history at the European University of Cyprus. He joins us from there. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Hi. Honored to be on this program.
How bad would it have been or would it be for Cyprus if, in fact, they went ahead with your colleague from the Cyprus Mail referred to as a punishment of prudent savers?
Well, the idea of a bail-in is the idea that you take from the savings that are locked in so that you can't take them out for an amount of time and you take from that. And that idea has a lot of merit. However, because Europe did not want to give 6 billion, the only way to reach that number, 6 billion, was to literally just raid any account, including bank accounts, pension funds, and unemployed people's. So actually, although the idea might have merit, instead of being a surgical strike, it was done with a chainsaw. So really, the chainsaw did its damage. I mean, our financial system was ruined the day the bail-in was put on the table. I mean, your correspondent just said something about from Frankfurt about why the Cyprus the Cyprus government did not want to just bail in, as we say, the over 100,000 depositors. And it's quite simple, because that takes all bank accounts, including pension funds. So you would just replace and current accounts, right? So you just replace a pension a financial sector crisis with a pension crisis. I mean, that's where the idea of taxing underneath the 100,000 came in. But it's quite clear that neither did Europe nor did the Cyprus government understand how violent the reaction would be of attacking insured depositors. And because we're in an American audience, let us remind that Mr. Obama bailed out AIG not because he liked the insurance sector, but because he realized that messing with people and companies that are insured is the surefire way of unraveling the whole financial system.
Describe what happened on the streets of Nicosia and other places in Cyprus when this was announced.
No, there was a concern, but there was the idea that we'll figure it out. And the more as days go by, there was anger because it was understood that we keep hearing in the program that we have a big banking sector, but you see all small islands have a big banking sector. We have a big banking sector because our interest rates are high. Our interest rates are high because we were invaded by Turkey in 1974. So the government needs to borrow expensively, so therefore the banks need to have higher interest rates. So really, we thought that there would be some sort of solidarity because it was an understanding that we wouldn't be in this financial shape if there wasn't the Greek haircut on government debt. And we thought that really the investors of the government debt would take a hit. In fact, we didn't have the investors take any hit, but we did it. So that was where the real anger, I think, lies.
Okay. We need to take a very brief break. I want to say goodbye to Jack Ewing in Frankfurt for the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune. Thank you very much for being on our program. We're going to continue this conversation later on Reporter's Notebook, Sex, Celebrity, and Politics in South Carolina. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Warman, only back with To the Point, talking about the banks in Cyprus and who should bail them out now that they are in trouble. Should it be Eurozone partners, including Germany? What would that mean with regard to the Russian oligarchs and others who allegedly park their money in Cypriot banks as tax havens? Should it also include the smaller depositors, pensioners, and students trying to save up for a rainy day? Jacob Kierkegaard is an economist and research fellow at the Peterson Institute of International Economics in Washington. Good to have you on our program.
Pleasure to be here.
When this first came out, you were quoted as saying that the deposit tax was a good solution. Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, I basically, you know, desperate times calls for desperate measures, unfortunately. And the reality is that Cyprus is broke. It has very large banks that are bust. And that in order to qualify for what is still, and I think we need to keep that in mind, a very sizable bailout from the international community of fully 60% or so of GDP, which is considerably more than both Portugal, Ireland, and even Greece initially received in bailout, Cyprus has been tasked with raising 5.8 billion euros, which is about 30% of Cypriot GDP. The solution was put to them that you tax depositors, because that actually has the advantage from the perspective of the Cypriot government that you also tax non-residents, meaning first and foremost, of course, Russian depositors, and thereby raising potentially a substantial amount of revenue, which is revenue that otherwise the Cypriot government would have had to come up with by, you know, cutting government pensions or other types of austerity measures. So while I personally believe it was a political mistake by the Cypriot government to not put all of the levy onto uninsured depositors above 100,000. The fact that you're using this levy, I actually think makes quite a lot of financial sense in the particular circumstances of Cyprus.
Let me go back to Alexander Apostolidis at the European University of Cyprus. What would this have meant for such investors as private hospitals and small businesses and others in Cyprus?
Well, that's exactly the point. The idea might be solid. The way it was implemented was disastrous because, first of all, the idea of Dr. Kierkegaard, which is to hit the higher, as you said, the people earning substantial amounts of money that park their money in Cyprus because of high interest, actually, because it also affects current accounts, it made a massive dislocation of the financial system. So I can give you very good examples of even small and large persons. I know a person who just got a loan to buy a house for $300,000, and that got haircutted, so he cannot now actually buy a loan. So he cannot buy the house. So the litigation and the mess that it creates is messy. He's absolutely right. That's a great idea when you have one or two banks, but when you do it across the board, and especially when you do it to banks that were very well run, and now you say depositors that actually chose lower interest rates with well-run banks, you know, you're going to actually have to do this too. I mean, that's the problem. And we could reduce that 5.8 billion by quite simply restructuring our government debt. In fact, there was a paper by Giulatti and Liboukaid who did the Greek government haircut, and they say you could easily get up to 2 billion by doing that. So really, although it might have been a solution and part of a package, the pain was not spread equally. The investors who bought the government bonds at cheap discounts are not going to be affected, and that makes people very, very angry.
So, Jacob Kierkegaard, you said it was probably a political mistake to go for the smaller depositors, but in any case, the parliament has rejected the idea. What do you think is going to happen now?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, a sovereign entity like a parliament has a decision until it has it takes a new one. And I think what we saw here in the United States was after, you know, Congress rejected TARP once, then a few days later it changed its mind. And I would quite frankly expect somewhat of the same to ultimately happen in Cyprus, a little bit like what the initial guest said. I think what's happening right now is that by sort of rejecting this deposit levy initially, there a couple of days or maybe a week of time has been bought. But during this time, the Cypriot banks remain closed. The economic dislocation domestically in Cyprus keeps going up and thereby increasing the political and economic pressure on the Cypriot government and parliament to resolve this situation. So what we're seeing now is alternatives, avenues, some in Russia, some elsewhere, are being pursued in order to raise the necessary co-financing for this bailout. And I would expect them to come up with, you know, maybe a couple of billions from some source and thereby be able to lower at least the depositor level or depositor levy and quite likely exempting the smaller depositors and only affecting the larger depositors or perhaps only also larger depositors of individual institutions. Who knows? But I do believe that in the coming days, some shape or form of this type of depositor levy will pass the Cypriot Parliament.
Do you think that there will be a haircut of one kind or another, difficulty, let us say, for people like the man who wants to buy the house for $300,000? Are all Cypriots going to ultimately have to pay something because of what's happened to the banks?
I think given the magnitude of the amount of money that needs to be raised, I think you will have to have a fairly broad-based depositor levy, which could potentially affect people in the unfortunate situation described with a home buyer. I think that a lot of people will be caught in the crossfire of this. I think that's inevitable, given the scale of the crisis.
What about what we heard earlier, that trust in the banking system is at stake here, and the president of the country is concerned that there won't be any more deposits if, in fact, the banks don't appear to be sound from Russia or anyplace else?
Well, I think that irrespective of what happens, whatever deal is ultimately struck, I would expect a lot of people to want to take their money out of at least the two large Cypriot banks the minute they open, which means that I don't believe you will be able to open these banks without imposing some sort of restrictions on the amount of money you can take out. And other types of potentially capital controls, simply the amount of money you can take out of Cyprus. I think that is inevitable, given the distrust of these banks that are already in place.
Jacob Kierkegaard at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Also speaking to us from Washington, Uri Dadush, who is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I understand that you disagree with Jacob Kierkegaard, who said that early on this sounded like a good idea. Why do you think it's a bad idea? And what about the precedent that it sets, given that this wasn't the solution chosen for all the other countries that have been bailed out?
Well, in a nutshell, I think the proposal to tax deposits across the board, including insured deposits, is legally dubious, morally unjustified, managerially inept, and economically stupid. And let me just elaborate just very quickly. It's legally dubious because these deposits, to a large degree, were insured and were understood to be insured, whatever the mechanics of the actual expropriation might be. They're morally unjustified because they hit ordinary Cypriots who were receiving low or moderate interest rates on their deposits, assured that they were safe, and had absolutely no responsibility in whatever mistaken behavior there was on the part of the Cypriot banks. It's managerially inept because clearly there are alternatives to what they did. Some of them were already discussed, the restructuring of government debt. Others have not been discussed today, but Cyprus is expecting a gas bonanza some years down the road. There could be additional loans from various sources, including from the Europeans, against those gas reserves. It's managerially inept because clearly the Russians that are playing a very important role in this whole episode were not adequately involved and engaged. And finally, as you appear to indicate, it is economically stupid because it sets a very dangerous precedent. It will, of course, cause a panic in Cyprus. And once the banks are opened, we're going to be facing a terrible problem. But more importantly, it reduces the margin for maneuver on every other country that is under pressure in the EU. Because whatever they say, when the moment comes that Italy or Spain or Portugal or whoever is again under pressure, ordinary people will have learned a lesson from what happened in Cyprus and will be running for the doors.
So is the system sustainable if all of these bad scenarios are so likely?
Well, I think the system is sustainable so long as you have, I do believe the system is sustainable and has to be sustained, because a collapse of the euro would be a disaster virtually without precedent in the for the global economy and, of course, for the European economies. But in order for it to be sustained, you have to have some intelligent decision-making. And intelligent decision-making in this particular case would have been to find another way to get the money to Cyprus. And I suspect that that's what will happen. But unfortunately, a lot of damage has been done already.
Uri Dadush at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Back to Jacob Kierkegaard at the Peterson Institute. Mr. Dadush mentioned the gas bonanza to come from reserves offshore from Cyprus. There's going to be a lot of competition for those. And aren't the Russians concerned about that? Because at the moment, they're supplying gas to Europe.
Well, I mean, you know, one of the loose rumors that we've heard is that Gazprom or other Russian entity, government-linked entities have, you know, offered to buy these concessions for a considerable amount of money. So, I mean, I wouldn't be I mean, it's clear that if it turns out to indeed be the case that there are these large yet unexploited gas reserves in under Cypriot territorial waters. Well, yeah, I mean, this is good for longer term Cypriot, you know, debt sustainability. But I guess I disagree with Uri that these potential future gains, highly uncertain gains, is of particular relevance in solving the very immediate crisis in Cyprus.
Then are there other alternatives to the bailout via tax that you would suggest?
Well, I mean, you know, there is no optimal or no good solutions in this situation. And I think the one that was chosen, because we are talking about for Cyprus to raise about, 30% of GDP in order to bring down the total size of the bailout to a, I believe, long-term sustainable size. You know, they could have chosen to, do more austerity or other issues. Privatizations would probably be the one that I would think of, because the Cypriot government does hold substantial, government-owned utilities and other economic interests. But the problem about doing that is, of course, at this very moment, potential buyers, they know very well that the Cypriot government has a gun to their head and needs to sell. So they're going to be negotiating very hardly. And therefore, the Cypriot government is probably not going to be able to get the fair value for those types of assets. So in the end, when we compare these alternative scenarios and these alternatives, opportunities that are there, I still come down and I say that I think this levy is actually the least bad option.
Let me go back to Alexander Apostolidis, at the European University of Cyprus. How do Cypriots feel about these assets that are supposedly located offshore? What about government-owned utilities, for example, and how valuable are they in a country that only has 1.1 million people?
First of all, I have to say I agree absolutely with Yuri when you see, I mean, Blackboard economics are fine, but something about this tax that wasn't mentioned is time inconsistent. From the moment you put it once, you actually create, you don't allow that person to buy his house, so GDP goes down, so any estimates of the bailout are wrong anyway, and you need a second bailout. I mean, we've seen this with Greece, and we are being pushed in that direction. We came into this bailout to save our banking sector, and our banking sector collapsed just by the announcement of the tax. So really, I mean, although it might be a good idea, there's other ways to find the money, and we know about them. However, the reason they're not being explored is we've been prevented from the Eurozone because it will affect Italian and Spanish bond yields. I mean,
we could just restructure our government debt. It's difficult, but Greece has done it as well. But that would create chaos in the Italian market. Right now, Italy is facing perhaps a second round of elections. So really, and let's go back. The Cypriots are really upset because let's remember that 4 billion of all these losses, so we're talking out of the 5.8 billion, 4 billion out of these losses came directly by the decision of the Europeans to haircut the Greek government debt. And we didn't veto out of many reasons. That's probably the biggest mistake our government did. But we felt, because of cultural ties, that it was a part of solidarity towards the Greeks. So really, I do think that the Cypriots here, first of all, do not understand the technical issues behind it. They do not understand why insured people should be affected. And from the moment you say it, The fact that there's no central bank in Eurozone that is willing to back banks to the hilt suddenly makes all insurance deposits look conditional to the whims of the Eurogroup. I mean, you have a very, very good central bank that is willing to back banks and is willing to close bad ones. Here we have a central bank that decided through this to penalize good and bad banks, and that really is very inconsistent. And as for the idea, I mean, these ideas have a tendency to come back. Don't be surprised if you see similar ideas with Detroit now, with Marshall Islands. I think the worst export of this will not be the crisis itself, because that will only affect the region, but really the worst export will be that the idea really can work. And that's our biggest worry. I mean, we have to kill. The idea might be good for one or two banks, but when it comes to the whole economy, it creates macroeconomic disaster.
Uri Dadush, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I tend to. Yes, of course, I agree. I think that.
So this could have a very broad, very widespread impact.
Yes, and it will. And it will have an impact on the rest of the Eurozone. I would not be surprised at all to see in coming months some increased, maybe gradual, even if it's not a panic, capital flight, deposit flight out of Italy, Spain, the other countries in trouble. I would also expect, under any circumstance, people who have deposits above 100,000 euros to restructure them into smaller deposits. And I would also expect that, as I have said already, in a time of crisis, let's say during prolonged uncertainty in the run-up to the Italian elections, expect by all means that ordinary Italians will be trying to take their money out of the country.
Okay, Jacob Kierkegaard.
Because everybody understands.
Excuse me for interrupting you, but we're just out of time. Jacob Kierkegaard, very quickly, are you less pessimistic?
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, I don't think the chances of contagious retail depositor bank runs or bank jogs, if you like, are zero. But on the other hand, I don't think that the prospects of this happening are particularly alarming, okay. Quite frankly.
All right. Well, thank you all very much. Jacob Kierkegaard again at the Peterson Institute, Uri Dadush at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Alexander Apostolidis at the European University of Cyprus, and our earlier guest, Jack Ewing, with the New York Times and the International Tribune, who joined us from Frankfurt, and Stefanos Oropidou, who was with the Cyprus Mail, joining us from Nicosia in Cyprus itself. Remember Mark Sanford, South Carolina's former Republican governor? When he disappeared for 6 days and said he'd been hiking the Appalachian Trail, it turned out he was really in Argentina pursuing a mistress. Well, he's back, trying to regain his old seat in Congress. The result just might be a win for the Democrats in one of the reddest states in the Union. Back in a moment with To the Point.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Mormon Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. There were 16 Republicans in yesterday's primary for South Carolina's 1st Congressional District. The seat became vacant when incumbent Tim Scott was appointed to the U.S. Senate. During his campaign, Mark Sanford, the former governor, ran TV commercials referring to the high-profile philandering that led to divorce and apparent disgrace.
More recently, I've experienced how none of us go through life without mistakes. But in their wake, we can learn a lot about grace, a God of second chances, and be the better for it. In that light, I humbly step forward and ask for your help in changing Washington.
Well, former Governor Stanford won the primary, but he only got 37% in a low primary turnout. Now he'll be in a runoff to stand against the Democratic nominee, Elizabeth Colbert Bush. She is the sister of cable TV comedian Stephen Colbert. Scott Huffman is professor of political science at Winthrop University in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Are we seeing the rebound and recovery of the former governor or not?
Well, he referenced a god of second chances, and somebody certainly gave him a second chance. There's no doubt about that. He overwhelmingly claimed victory in this first round. But South Carolina has a primary system where if you don't get 50% in the primary, you go to a runoff. So he now has to face the second place vote getter in a runoff. But the second place vote getter only got 13%. Now, the overall turnout for this entire special election primary was 16%. So it was a very low turnout affair overall. And he is the front runner going into this runoff, although it's not a sure thing. And whoever wins the runoff will face Elizabeth Colbert Bush.
Do you think he got it by name recognition?
Well, I think you can attribute nearly all of his vote to name recognition and familiarity. It was a very short window, a very short campaign time. And so anybody who, you know, knew the ropes of how to run a campaign did not have to reintroduce themselves to the voters, had an advantage. You add to that deep pockets, and then 15 people that most folks had never heard of, a good half of them quite literally had never, you know, heard of those candidates. So he went in with a huge edge, but on the panels and the forums in which he appeared, he performed head and shoulders above everybody else simply because he was comfortable being in the spotlight. He's good at spinning a yarn. He can tell a story about how back when he was in Congress before, he faced down the leadership over this spending bill or that one. He's very good in the spotlight. He's very comfortable with people one-on-one. He looked good on the platform, in front of the podium, and he had a lot of money and name recognition. You combine that, and I think that explains his overwhelming first-place finish here.
Well, tell us now about Elizabeth Colbert Bush, who doesn't pronounce her name the same way Stephen Colbert, her brother, does. What's her background, and how's a Democrat going to do in South Carolina?
Right. Well, Stephen Colbert and Elizabeth Colbert Bush, they're both, you know, from South Carolina, grew up here. Apparently, I believe the story is at some point they were told the history of their name and said, you can choose to pronounce it Colbert or Colbert. Both are correct. And, you know, there were 11 or 12 kids. It was a huge family. And she chose Colbert and Colbert Bush. She's going to have a tough time. There's no doubt about it. After the last census, there are now 7 congressional districts in South Carolina. There were 6. They are heavily gerrymandered because of the creation of a majority-minority district, which is the 6th congressional district here. That's Jim Clyburn's district. So our districts range from overwhelmingly African-American and Democratic with Jim Clyburn's district to strongly Republican and ridiculously strong Republican. And those are really the only choices. And this is a strongly Republican district. There are a couple of districts where, you know, sometimes a Democrat doesn't even run. This is a district that is Republican dominant. It's going to be hard for any Democrat to win. Elizabeth Colbert Bush has been a director of business development down there in North Charleston for a while. She's seen as a pro-business, not, you know, lefty Democrat. That's going to help her. Her side, I think, is actually hoping to run against Mark Sanford because they think that's the only way that they're going to have a chance is that if anybody recoils from their otherwise Republican-leaning preference because it's Mark Sanford. So I actually think they may be hoping to face Mark Sanford despite his name recognition.
Let's just go over the case against Mark Sanford a little bit. He disappeared for 6 days while he was governor of the state. Nobody knew where he was. When he came back, he said he was taking a hike on the Appalachian Trail. And then it turned out that, in fact, he was visiting with the mistress in Buenos Aires.
Right. Then it was Father's Day, and he left and told his his spokesperson, he was going on a hike on the Appalachian Trail, did not leave any information for the lieutenant governor of who would be in charge. When he couldn't be tracked down, an intrepid reporter with a source many of us suspect but is still unnamed, tracked him down at the Atlanta airport as he returned from Argentina.
Now, he then subsequently, his wife divorced him. He apparently asked her to help run his campaign for Congress when he was running for his old seat again?
That is true. That takes...
The cake.
Yes, that's a good way to put it. That takes something. He did. Jenny Sanford is liked. She's respected. She is also a hard-nosed fighter. She's the one who really got Mark Sanford elected in all his races, ran his races, ran his campaigns. She's a tough-as-nails campaigner who knows what she's doing. Mark Sanford apparently just assumed that she would do that for him again. I don't know if he brought his now fiance with him to ask if she would run his campaign, but he did, in fact, ask his ex-wife to run his campaign. She demurred.
Okay. It leads to all kinds of speculation, lurid and otherwise. Is Stephen Colbert campaigning down there?
He has. More fundraising. So he has made fundraising appearances for his sister. I would, strongly suspect that, he'll do it before the general election. So I expect to see him down here again.
Scott Huffman at Winthrop University, Rock Hill, South Carolina. Many thanks to you.
Thank you.
Today's program produced by Carrie Cavanaugh, Evan George, Gideon Browder, technical director from Phil Richards. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.